Lloyd Austin said that if Ukraine falls, he believes that NATO will be at war with Russia. Putin, in his address to nations, said that Russia's strategic nuclear forces are in a state of full readiness. Where are we heading, in your opinion? Where are we going?
Well, I think the West is going to back off finally. I mean, they're talking tough. They make lots of threats. But, you know, what was it, a couple of weeks ago, the Brits tried to test launch one of their nukes out of a submarine. And I wrote an article that was playing off of, you know, male erectile dysfunction. I called it ejectile dysfunction. They couldn't get it up. They couldn't get it out. It plop, you know, fell into the water. So, you know, and the Brits, who are the, you know, used to be one of the vanguard nations in NATO, they're talking about selling one of their two aircraft carriers because the thing is constantly broken, which raises the question, who the hell wants to buy that piece of junk? Okay? I mean, seriously, you're going to shell out $8 billion for an aircraft carrier that can't even get out of port? So you got that kind of bellicose talk from UK, but they don't have any way to deliver. I mean, you know, there's no big blue pill that will provide them with the energy they need to create any kind of threat. Similarly, there's Macron in France, raising, oh boy, we could really deploy new NATO troops. And everybody else in NATO went, are you out of your friggin' mind? Hell no. No. We're not doing that. The Germans said no. By the Germans. And, you know, clearly the Hungarians said no. And the Dutch and the Czechs. And, you know, so here's Macron to figure out what, you know, what was he smoking when he said that? Then you get the Germans, Scholz, acknowledging that, yeah, you know, the Brits are in there on the ground in Ukraine operating weapons, attacking Russians. And, you know, we think it's a bad idea. We think long-range missiles is a bad idea because it could, you know, elicit a retaliation. So all of that's being said from the NATO side, right? So then you come to what, as you talked to mentioned, Putin, what he said. And he made it very clear. If you attack us, we've got nukes and we will retaliate. We will protect ourselves. Real simple. I mean, he said it in a much more drawn out fashion, but that was the bottom line. So the West better pay attention because right now they are engaged in acts of war against Russia. The West, the United States, England, Germany are attacking Russia. They're killing Russian civilians. It's a casus belli. It would give Russia would have every reason in the world to launch missiles and rockets against U.S. military bases, against U.S. cities, against U.S. defense installations, at both you know, the continental United States and then in Europe, against military bases in Europe. It hasn't done so yet. And it depends on how far the West is willing to go in ratcheting up the threat against Russia. I think at the, you know, when they'll come to their senses and back off because they don't want to risk destruction. They can't, the West does not have enough military might to defeat Russia, period. It does not. And they can talk about how great their military power is. Again, look at Great Britain. It's a joke. It's like a Monty Python skit on steroids. They can't get enough recruits. They're advertising on LinkedIn for somebody to be in charge of their submarine fleet, which is their primary means for delivering nuclear weapons. They can't even run a good nuclear weapons test from a submarine because it failed. But they want to take on Russia. Hell, they can't even... They can't even recruit enough people to fill the slots they need to fill in their army and navy and air force. Same for the United States. So, I mean, all these people, they're living in some sort of delusional fantasy land. And someone just needs to slap them upside the head and say, okay, come back to reality. Get a grip. Let's recognize that Russia is a nuclear-capable country with hypersonic missiles that can defeat any air defense system the West would pretend to offer to defeat it, and that Russia's submarine fleet is robust and they have new capabilities there that the West cannot match, and that Russia is willing, if pushed, to use all necessary means to defend itself, which would mean the destruction of the West. Do you really want that? Do you really want that? That's the question they need to answer. And I think ultimately they'll say, okay, yeah, we're not interested in this fight. And figure out a way that they can sit down, talk to Russia, and recognize there are, in theory, a lot more common grounds for agreement between the West and Russia. I mean, first and foremost, Russia has set the example of how a country that is multi-ethnic to a degree that most other countries are not. It has 190 different ethnic groups, and we're not talking just very, very small minority populations. They've got significant numbers of these people throughout and across the 11 time zones that Russia occupies. And yet they figured out a way that each of those ethnicities can retain their identity but still be Russian, and that the one thing they share in common is that they love Russia. So to find the way to be a genuine nation unified around that concept, but also be a nation that's not out constantly meddling in the affairs of other countries. And the United States and Europe are the ultimate meddlers in carrying out activities to overthrow a variety of governments around the world. And, you know, frankly, I'm tired of it. I think it has got to end. This is a sickness. United States has gotten away with it now for 70 years. It's got to stop. It's caused too much death, too much destruction.
I was totally surprised when Macron said that he's willing to send troops to Ukraine, because he was totally different from the beginning of this conflict. He was trying to have some sort of common ground between the West and Russia and find some sort of solution for this conflict. Right now, he's coming out of nowhere and talking about sending troops to Ukraine. And even in France, the polls show that 68% of people are against these kind of policies.
Maybe he has a death wish. I don't know. You know, maybe he's keen on committing suicide. Because you're right. It's not, it'd be one thing to say this if the French public was saying, vive la France, let's go for it. Let's get into a fight with Russia. They don't want that. The French public, they don't want that at all. And then, it'd be one thing again if Macron was being put out front to speak on behalf of the rest of the NATO countries, and that, none of them necessarily wanted to stand up and say this, and they're going to let Macron do it. Well, he said that, and it immediately got slapped down by everybody else from Italy, Spain, Germany, across the board. Everybody looking at him saying, "You out of your mind?" The United States said, no, we're not doing that. So I beats me. It's completely puzzling. It is irrational on his part, and it's politically very stupid. But, nobody ever claimed that Macron was a really smart guy. He was just, he knew how to play the politics to get elected.
It seems that Great Britain is urging Germany to send Taurus missiles to Kiev.
Great Britain, number one, is not great, okay? It's called Britain. It's no longer great. It's insignificant. It's mediocre at best. So they're encouraging Germany to do what the UK can't. The UK had Storm Shadow missiles. They turned out to be a bust. And so they want the Germans to use the Taurus, and the Germans going, I don't think so. And Scholz has made it very clear that we're not going to up the ante now to run the risk of engaging Russia militarily. I mean, the Brits are the ones that they lack the capability to act. Therefore, in their frustration, they're asking everybody else to do what they can't do. They need to be ignored. the Britain, the so-called United Kingdom, it's a joke. Yeah, it is an impotent power, incapable of projecting force anywhere, and with diplomacy in disarray. You know, they can talk all sorts of, they make threats, they can talk tough, thump their chest. When all said and done, there's nothing they can do. They are no match for Russia. That's a fact.
Ukrainian army is asking for F-16s that they think that it's going to be a game changer in Ukraine in this war against Russia. And Politico published an article that said F-16s could become a burden for the Ukrainian army because of the level of maintenance that they would need for this type of fighters. In your opinion, why they're asking for these F-16s if they have no capabilities for maintaining them?
Yeah, well, let's be clear about one thing. Political is wrong. It's not that Ukraine may have trouble maintaining them. It will have trouble. It is not capable of maintaining them. It does not have the trained pilots to fly them. And even if they get them, it's not going to change the game on the ground because that aircraft has limited reach. And every fifth generation Russian fighter bomber can identify and engage the F-16 well before the F-16 can identify and engage them. They're going to get shot down. And if they land on a combat airfield, unless they're out there sweeping it up and making it immaculate, the engines are going to suck in trash, and the engines are going to be trashed themselves, not going to operate. It makes no difference. There is no wonder weapon out there. Ukraine's problem is real simple, not complicated. They don't have enough trained soldiers, period. They have no way to get more trained soldiers, period. They're done. It's a matter of time. You know, if you've ever seen a chicken without its head, you can cut the head of a chicken off and it will still run around for a bit. But it doesn't have a head and it's pumping blood out of its neck. And at some point, it's going to run out of blood and it's going to fall over dead. That's Ukraine. Ukraine's head has been cut off. It's running around, creating a lot of activity. It's dead. It's a dead country walking.
Canadian Defense Minister said that they're considering sending troops to Ukraine. How do you find them? How capable are they?
If the Ukrainian troops are great, why do they need Canadians? Or Brits? Or French? Or Germans? Or Americans? Hey, if everything's hunky-dory with Ukraine, why do they need these foreign troops? Well, things are not great with Ukraine. There wasn't in the early going, yes, the Ukrainian troops that were the frontline troops, they were quite competent. They were well trained. They were, you know, they're very brave. I'm not in question at all their bravery. But they've been killed. They've been eliminated. So what you're working with now are, you know, as they say, on average, the average age is 44 years of age. Those are old guys in military terms. They're not. They don't have the kind of endurance and strength that's needed to stay out on the battlefield. So, you know, the fact that Canada's talking, I hope the Canadians send a whole lot over there. Kill all of them. See how many Canadians could be killed. The world will be better off without those kinds of people, candidly. They've been enablers of Nazis. I have zero sympathy for those kind of people. So, yeah, let the Canadians go kill themselves. All these foreign mercenaries, go for it, guys. I hope the Russians stack the bodies high.
When you look at this trajectory of Germany's behavior during this conflict, from economic partner with Russia getting to the worst enemy of Russia, what's the future that this administration in Germany is looking for, in your opinion?
Isn't it suicide? Germany apparently didn't learn the lesson of World War II. Russia, frankly, with the benefit of hindsight now, shouldn't even have allowed the United States, United Kingdom, or France to have any sectors in Berlin. Should have taken it completely over and completely subjected and destroyed Germany. You know, the Germans by trying to resurrect Nazism. And let's be clear, when we're talking about people being Nazis, what we're talking about is an ideology, a belief that there is a racial group that's superior to others, one that is inherent, that it's, this gets down to concepts of racial purity. So that if you are Brazilian, you're not necessarily an Aryan. You're not as good a person. And that's why it's so pernicious, because the entire premise in the United States of America with this establishment, even though we didn't live up to our ideals, was that all men, but that was referring to men and women, all people are created equal in the eyes of God. So that was a fundamental belief here. And that meant you had to value the right of every individual, that their rights of life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, freedom of speech, that those were granted by God, not granted by the state. And therefore, you had to respect the rights of each individual. Now, again, the United States failed to live up to those ideals by allowing slavery during its early years and paid a price for it in the Civil War. But that principle, that doesn't invalidate the principle. And that's why that kind of belief that the rights of the individual surpass the rights of the national socialists is what we're talking about. Because the national socialist movement, whether it's neo-Nazi or old Nazi, is all about declaring one group as superior, both intellectually, morally, in terms of religion, that they have rights that nobody else does. And that's why if you were subhuman, if you're that subhuman category, it's easy to kill you, to get rid of you. So, that's what we're looking at in this conflict. That's what Russia's fighting against.
Newsweek and Bloomberg, in shocking articles, they're talking about that this war can end this year by summer. How possible is that, and how likely is that?
Well, I think it's highly likely. I don't see how Ukraine survives to the end of August. Again, they don't have the manpower. Wake up. If you don't have soldiers that can man fighting positions, then you do not have a way to prevail in this kind of conflict. That simple. It'll be, like I said, they'll be lucky to still be around by August. The Russian military has dramatically stepped up its attack, and it's surging all along the line, and Ukraine doesn't have an answer for it. They don't have the weapons. They don't have the ammunition. They don't have the trained personnel. That's the key. No trained personnel. You can't operate in an army.
At the border with Poland, they're having problems. Polish farmers, they're not happy with the situation at the border. At the same time, they don't have access to the Black Sea. But it doesn't seem that the Biden administration considering any of this when it comes to the future of Ukraine.
Biden's distracted. They're worrying about Israel. There's a lot more Jewish money flowing around the halls of Congress and in Republican and Democrat circles than there is Ukrainian money. Ukraine's now an afterthought. They're going to be an afterthought. That's why that one article that came out in the New York Times last Monday, talking about, oh, look how much CIA's been involved with Ukraine. That's over. They're going to be abandoned. I think some Ukrainians are finally coming to that realization, but they're on their own. They've lost.
Lavrov believes that not only mercenaries, we have career officers in Ukraine who are fighting Russians. Are they getting paid by governments?
Well, yeah, no, of course they're getting paid. I mean, they're not doing this for free. This is, in a lot of the cases, they're going through just a cosmetic legal process to pretend that they've separated from service, that they're there on their own as private citizens, when in fact they're fighting, they're carrying out military duties on behalf of the United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, Poland, whatever. So Russia's aware of it. That's part of the reason Lavrov and Putin are talking about this now. They're putting the West on notice. We know what you're doing. And if you keep it up, you're going to pay a price. Real simple. Not complicated.
The other thing that Putin in his address to nations said that those who think that Russia will attack Europe are totally wrong because there is nothing in it for Russia to attack Europe. He says it again and again, and nobody seems to care to understand, to hear this on the part of the West.
Well, look, Russia will attack Europe if Europe attacks Russia. You can make the case that Europe is already attacking Russia, and therefore Russia would be fully entitled to punch back. So far, they haven't. If the Germans or the French or the Brits persist, or the United States introduce long-range missiles, and those strike into Russia and start killing more Russian civilians on Russian territory, then yes, at that point, I think you'll see Russia strike back at the targets inside Europe. They're not going to let them get away with it. They're going to send them a very clear message. And this is going to, and what this will expose is the limited power of the West, that they won't have, they have no air defense system to prevent what Russia will hit them with. Russia's got at least three different varieties, the Zircon, Iskander, missile, hypersonic missiles that can evade any defense system, air defense system the West has, and can strike devastating blows. So we'll see what happens.
It's so amazing to see nothing's coming from Poland. If you remember when this conflict started, Poland was in the front line talking about this war. Let's fight with Russia.
Yeah.
What's happening right now in Poland?
Well, I mean, the Polish farmers are putting enormous pressure on, preventing the import of Ukrainian grain. That's also tying up and preventing the arrival of military supplies from the rest of NATO that normally would pass through either Poland or Romania. You're seeing similar opposition in Romania as well. Let's be clear, this is not just confined to Poland. The tensions between the Poles and the Ukrainians are going up at the very time that this is the very time when, Ukraine needs to have the most cordial relations possible with Poland and with Romania, but instead of going the opposite direction. It's just one other symbol or example of the fact that Ukraine is coming apart at the seams politically. There is not solid political support for Zelensky. He has not solidified his position. He's not rallying the people to his side or going, oh my God, we love Zelensky. Let's protect him. He has gotten rid of the most popular general, Zeluzhny. And Zeluzhny is apparently allied with Poroshenko and with the mayor, Klitschko, of Kiev. So, they've set the stage for some great political chaos. Plus, you say, hey, we're not going to hold elections. And so I'm going to just declare myself president. We're going to keep going on.
Ukrainian intelligence says that there are reports that there are some attempts in Ukraine that want to overthrow Zelensky by spring. On the other hand, we had CIA Director William Burns went to Kiev to meet with Zelensky. Do you think, are these two related to each other?
Well, no, I think the coup attempt is going to be carried out probably by people with military ties to Zeluzhny is the most likely. Burns is just trying to see if he can keep the lid on all of this, but, limited ability. We saw that, that article that was leaked to the New York Times on Monday by Adam Entus and Michael Schwartz. It was sending a clear signal that trying to build a storyline. Oh, look, the United States has done everything in its power to help Ukraine. Now it's, those damn Republicans, they've not provided any more money. And, Ukraine really doesn't have the ability to hang on. But the Ukrainians have been tough to deal with because this character, Budinov, is a little bit out of control. And he's a loose cannon. That was the message of that article. Well, then what did Budinov do? Well, the United States had been saying, oh, the Russians killed Alexei Navalny, the political dissident. And Budinov says, no, they didn't. He died of a blood clot, natural causes. So right there, contradicts the United States. United States says, oh, Russia is relying heavily on North Korean and Iranian missiles. Budinov, no, they're not. No, no, that's not true. So clearly, the whatever control the Central Intelligence Agency thought it had over Budinov doesn't exist. Budinov is making his own sound, his own noise. And, you know, without U.S. support, though, the Ukrainians are screwed. They don't have a good alternative. So the thing's a mess. It's not going to get better. It's not like they're going to all have a, you know, a visit from God and go, oh, yeah, let's all join hands and sing Kumbaya and let's agree that we need to fight the Russians. You know, it's not going to happen. So stop with all the magical thinking.
As long as the United States is sending more aids and weapons, more money to Ukraine, they can have some sort of control on Ukrainians. When they caught this, is the U.S. capable of controlling the government, the people in Ukraine, these people, these elites in Ukraine?
Just people need to study history, okay? Go back to Vietnam. So the United States gets heavily invested in Vietnam and heavily invested in trying to control the political processes and select who's going to be in charge and, you know, play the puppet master behind the scenes. But there always comes a point where the United States loses control because these people, they're, you know, the Ukrainians have their own power base. And yes, they can be heavily influenced by the United States, but there comes a point where they'll turn to the United States and say, screw you. We're not going to do what you want. We're going to do it our way. And that may turn out successfully, and it may turn out tragically. What happened to going to the Diem in Vietnam? You know, he was ultimately, they thought they'd engineered his removal, and they removed him, and the military killed him. Ditto with, you know, Saddam Hussein. He thought he'd had a deal with the United States and the United States would protect him. U.S. betrayed him. Same for Muammar Gaddafi. Same for Manuel Noriega. You know, the United States has a long tradition of making deals with reprehensible, despicable people. And that when they become dispensable, we get rid of them. We dispose of them. They're like a used Kleenex. They get tossed. And I think that that's what Zelensky and Budinov are facing. They're no longer going to be useful to the West. People like Burns go over there to try to reassure, oh, yeah, we're still your buddies. We're still your friends. Trust us. You know, we're like this. And then, you know, when the time comes to pull the plug on it, the plug will get pulled. And, you know, I think Zelensky will be lucky to survive this. I think he very well could get killed. You know, it would only take, I understand that they've had either a British Special Air Service providing and, you know, serving as bodyguards. It's not unheard of. I know that U.S. Special Operations Forces, both Delta Force and SEAL Team 6, have provided similar missions for other foreign leaders in the past. you know, there comes a time to say, okay, hey, guys, pull out. And all of a sudden, Zelensky is looking around and, where'd my security detail go? Uh-oh. The time's up.
Do we have any sort of information what's going on right now in Ukraine in terms of the public opinion, those people who are living in the western part of Ukraine?
Well, there have been public opinion polls coming out showing that Zelensky is highly unpopular. You know, I think he's got worse popularity rating in Ukraine than Joe Biden does in the United States, which is saying something. You know, at least in Zelensky's case, he's not senile. He may be a coke addict, but he's no longer a very funny comedian. But you know, he's alienated a significant number of the population. You know, it's not a good, stable political situation in Ukraine. He's not enjoying his status as a ruler that's viewed as enlightened, wise, courageous, smart, just the opposite. You know, he sold the country out. And Russia is beating Ukraine, bleeding them dry, bit by bit on the front. They're avoiding attacking the main cities, and they've avoided inflicting lots of suffering on the population, because I think Russia finally understands, like much of the West never did, that when you attack the civilian population of a country, instead of that igniting political opposition against the existing government, more often than not, it tends to build support for the existing government. So it's really sort of counterintuitive. What you want to do is not attack the civilians and do everything you can to decimate the military, which will then force the ruling authority to act in ways that will be very unproductive and hurt their own popularity and support among their people.
There are reports that Olaf Scholz and Macron cannot get along with each other.
They're not the only ones. I mean, you know, come on, Rishi Sunak, Giorgia Meloni, is it, of Italy? I don't recall who it is in Spain. You know, NATO is a joke, all right? It's an exclusive club that has catered and pampered its members. But in terms of getting them to actually carry out any kind of action together that would create any kind of military threat to someone like Russia, forget about it. They can't do it. Yeah, they're running an exercise right now. Big deal. They can't produce artillery shells. They've had now over a year to try. You know, the Ukraine started running out a year ago. So if, I worked for a retired Marine colonel, and he had a very colorful expression about, basically he said they couldn't pour piss out of a boot if you had the instructions written on the heel. Well, if you have a boot and you're going to read the instructions, you'd have to turn it over, which means that in gravity, it'd come out. And what he's saying is they can't even do that. They're not even that competent. That's what we're looking at.
There are two concepts when it comes to Europe. One says that this European Union is not working for Europe. And the other concept is, considering all these differences, they can work with each other. They can become an important power that can resist this pressure that comes from the United States, comes from the other superpowers. How do you see these two concepts?
Well, I think the Europeans got deluded, deceived by this notion that they could, that they're one thing. Oh, we're European. No, they're not. The French are different from the Germans, are different from the Brits, are different from the Italians, are different from the Swiss, are different from the Norwegians, are different from the Danes, are different from the Portuguese. Want me to keep going? Different from Hungarians, different from Slovaks, different from Czechs, different from Poles. What they ought to do is embrace their differences. The national identities of those different countries. Part of this has been this World Economic Forum nonsense, where they try to erase, classify all of this European as white. It's white. You know, there's no such thing as white. We are all different colors. I mean, this is white. That's white paper. I'm not white. I'm pink. You know, I'm a different color. So recognize, and anybody that's traveled around Europe would recognize, there are significant cultural differences, not only between Germany and France. Hell, go between in Germany, between Bavaria, southern Germany, and northern Germany. There are differences. Instead of trying to erase those differences, they ought to be embracing them and upholding them, and trying to say, okay, how can we coexist without destroying our identity as Frenchmen or as Englishmen or as Germans or as Poles or as Swiss, you know, as Hungarians, as Romanians, as Serbs. You know, this there's something to be said for preserving that national identity, but preserving it in a way that you don't assume that there's an inherent superiority, that because I'm German, therefore I am much better than the French or the German or the English. No, it's just you're different, and embrace your difference and celebrate that. That has sort of actually been one of the delights of being able to, if you could travel around Europe, or even when I was working at State Department, going to these meetings, like the European Civil Aviation Conference, dealing with the Germans and the French and the Irish and the Brits and the Scots and the Spanish and the Port, it was fun because they were all different, and they had cultural differences between them. So, Europe has been embarked on this bizarre, delusional quest to try to erase their national differences. And you erase those, you lose your identity. I think that's what they're coming to discover.
Netanyahu said that he's receiving a lot of pressures to have a ceasefire in Gaza.
Right.
But he's resisting all of them. How do you see the current situation in Gaza? Are we going to have a ceasefire?
No, there's not going to be a ceasefire. At least the only way a ceasefire will come, in my opinion, is after Israel launches its invasion into southern Lebanon against Hezbollah, and Hezbollah kicks the hell out of Israel, beats them, delivers a military defeat to the Israeli army. At that point, Israel will be faced with defeat, something that it has never faced in its 75 years of history. And then and only then will there be actual serious negotiations about a ceasefire. Until then, they're going to continue to kill, murder women, children, Palestinian civilians. I mean, the massacre they conducted yesterday, shooting guys who were just trying to get food. Unarmed individuals, shooting them. Those are it's just, again, it's very reminiscent of what the Nazis did to the Jews. And so here we now, the Jews are doing it to the Palestinians. It's shameful.
When it comes to the policy in Gaza so far in this conflict in Gaza, many people argue that Netanyahu and his administration trying to do something big for Israel, trying to leave a good legacy when they're gone. With the type of behavior, with the type of operations that they have been doing since October 7th, is it going to be a good legacy?
Let me put it this way. If there is a God, if you believe that there is a God that provides eternal judgment on people for their actions, the Israelis will be condemned to the fires of hell for what they've done. There's no source of pride in this execution of Palestinian women and children. There is no glory in that. They have dishonored themselves as a country. They've really called into question whether or not they even deserve to exist anymore as a nation, because they've demonstrated a complete disregard for humanity and have engaged in dehumanizing conduct. So, legacy. The legacy will be, these are the guys who destroyed Israel. And it's really a shame, because what a contrast, and I think we've talked about this before, when Adolf Eichmann was captured in Argentina and then brought back to Israel to stand trial for his role in having helped destroy Hungarian Jews and then having them transported to Auschwitz, the Israelis treated him with humanity. They did not torture him. They did not humiliate him. They made sure he had legal counsel. He was treated according to international law. Now, you could make the case that Israel would have been entirely justified to carry out all sorts of, to have peeled him of his skin alive and boiled him in oil and done all sorts of horrible things to him to make him pay for his role in the murder of millions of Jews. But they didn't. And That was, I would argue, one of the shining moments for Israel. Not now. What now is just, it puts the Israelis in the same league as the Nazis who destroyed the Jews at the Warsaw Ghetto, or the Polish freedom fighters in the Warsaw, city of Warsaw towards the end of the war in World War II. They are a murderous bunch of thugs, not professional soldiers, in my view, and they've not carried themselves with any kind of honor. They are, engaged in human rights violations and war crimes, and should be accordingly punished.
Right now, there are huge clashes in Tel Aviv against the government and against Netanyahu and his administration. Do you think that that's going to have some sort of pressure on them? Do you think that's going to change anything on their policy in Gaza?
So let's see what happens today as a result of Ramadan, and whether or not the Israelis crush any attempt of worshipers to come to the Al-Aqsa Mosque to worship. Let's not forget that, yes, there is political opposition to Netanyahu. He's not a popular figure. But the problem with that is, if they get rid of Netanyahu, that doesn't mean that the majority of the Israelis endorse a policy of peaceful accommodation with the Palestinians. Oh, no. They still hate the Palestinians, and they still embrace the policies that have been carried out by the likes of Netanyahu and his government. So, people need to get a good grip on that. It's not going to change Israel's fundamental policy towards the Palestinians.